Joseph becomes visibly an Egyptian. No longer evident to the father's eye, but in his place very much alive and alert, Joseph lived on in the Egyptian world, lived into it, one might say, for he went in harness to its claims, and they were heavy on him who, as a lad in his first life, had known no tasks and had no demands laid upon him, but spent time according to his whim. Here he was the more active, and that he now strove to rise to the height of God's purpose for him. His head was full of figures, facts, and things, all sorts of business details, and more than that, involved in a web of human problems and relations which always required most delicate handling, the threads of which led to Potiphar, to the dwarfs, to Montcalm, to God knows whom else in the house and outside it, in constant functioning, in short, of a kind that his early home, where Jacob now was, and the brothers, would never dream of. That home was far away, farther than 17 days, farther than Jacob had been from Isaac and Rebekah when he lived and looked into the Mesopotamian light of day. They, too, had had no idea, been able to form no picture of how their son lived or what his problems were. And from their day, he in his turn was estranged. Where a man lives, there is his world, a narrow circle of life, work, and experience. The rest is vague, though men have always been inclined to shift their center, to let the known sink into the mist and look into a different day. Naphtali's urge has been strong upon them to run off into the mist, to report strange news to those dwelling there who know only their own, and take back home something worth the knowing. In short, there was always traffic and intercourse. Even between the widely separated places of Jacob's land and Potiphar's, there always had been, time out of mind. Was not the man from Ur accustomed to change his horizon? Had he not been to the land of mud, though not so far into it as Joseph? Had not his sister bride, Joseph's ancestral grandmother, dwelt for a time in the house of women of that Pharaoh who then glittered in his horizon, not at Wayse, but farther north, nearer to Jacob's sphere? Always there had been contacts between that sphere and Joseph's present one, for the darkly beautiful Ishmael had taken to wife a daughter of the black earth, and from the marriage the half-Egyptian Ishmaelites had sprung, called and chosen to bring Joseph down hitherwards. And many like them traded between the rivers to and fro, and apron-skirted messengers had gone about 1,000 years and more with letters written on bricks carried within their garments' folds. But if this Naphtali nature had always been, yet now in Joseph's time it was as never before a regular, customary, and developed thing. For the land whither he was snatched and where he lived his second life was definitely a land of descendants, no longer piously self-sufficient and strict, as Ammon would have it be, but worldly and seeking the pleasures of the world, so that if a come-hither Asiatic lad had but a cunning gift at saying good night and could add 2 and 2, he could become the body-servant to a great Egyptian and goodness knows what besides. No, there was no lack of communications between Jacob's place and his darlings. But he whose affair it was to use them, since he knew his father's abode, but his father knew not his, for whom it would have been easy, as a great steward's right hand, and so skilled in all arrangements, to have arranged opportunity for this too, he did not do it. He did it not for many years. The reasons have long since become clear to us, and nearly all of them are comprehended in the one word, expectancy. The calf bleated not. It kept still as death. It did not let the cow know to what field the man had brought it, for in agreement with the man, it demanded expectation of the cow as well, however hard it might be for her. For needs must the cow consider her calf to be dead and mangled. Strange and confusing, too, it is, to think that Jacob, the old man back there in the mist, all this while held his son for dead. Confusing, in that on the one hand, one would like to be glad for him because he was mistaken, and on the other, one grieves for him precisely because of his mistake. For there are, we know, certain consolations for the death of a beloved one, though they may be of a sufficiently hollow and desolate kind. And so we may feel a double pity for that sorrowing old man, first, because he held Joseph for dead, and second, because he was not. The father heart lulled itself, no doubt with a thousand pangs, but yet with a gentle sense of soothing, in the security of death. It imaged his son as treasured up in death, unchangeable, inviolable, needing no more care, eternally the 17-year-old boy who had ridden off on White Huldah. And all this was a mistake, not only the affliction, but also the consolation which gradually surmounted it. For Joseph lived, and was exposed to all the chances and changes of life. He was snatched away, but not snatched out of time. He did not remain 17, but waxed and ripened in the place where he was, got to be 19, and 20, and 21. Certainly he was still Joseph, but the father would not have known him, at least not at the first glance. The stuff of his life was altered, while still wearing its triumphantly successful shape. It ripened and became a little broader and firmer, less a youth and more a young man. A few years more, and of the fabric of that Joseph whom his Rebecca father kissed at parting, little will be left, as little as though death had dissolved the flesh. Only, since it was not death but life that changed him, the shape to some extent remained. Not so faithfully or exactly as death would have preserved it in the spirit, and did, illusorily, in Jacob's mind. After all, in this matter of content and form, whether it is death or life that removes the loved object away from our eyes is perhaps not so important as we are prone to think. Likewise, we must consider that the substance of Joseph's life, by which, among all the changes and chances of his maturing youth, its form was preserved, was drawn from quite another sphere than the one which would have fed it had he remained under Jacob's eyes, and the fact influenced its form as well. He was nourished by the airs and juices of Egypt, ate Cami's food. The water of her river moistened and swelled his tissues and cells. Her sun irradiated them. He dressed in the linen from Egypt's flax, trod her soil, receiving from it the impulse of her silently shaping powers. Took in with his eyes every day the evidences shaped by the hand of man, the expression of her fundamental, all-embracing, decisive character. Lastly, he spoke her speech, and it gave to his tongue, his lips, his jaws, another shape than that they would have had. Very soon, Jacob the father would have said to him, "Damu, my seed, what is it with thy mouth? I know it no more." In short, Joseph, as he grew, became visibly an Egyptian, in form and manner, quickly, easily, unnoticeably, because he was a child of the world, pliant in body and mind, likewise very young and soft when he came into the land, and thus the reshaping of his person after the local type happened readily and painlessly, the more that physically he had, from God knows where, something Egyptian about him, the square shoulders, the slender limbs. And mentally, because it lay in his tradition, it was natural to him to live a stranger among the children of the land. Even at home, he and his, the children of Abram, had always been gerim and guests, long settled and well adapted, it is true, but with an inner reserve and looking with detachment upon the easy-going Baal abominations of the real children of Canaan. So now, Joseph in Egypt. As a child of the world, he found it simple to conform and to practice detachment at one and the same time. For the one made the other easier, and drew out the sting of his fear lest he be disloyal to him, Elohim, who had brought him into this land, and upon whose countenance and indulgence he might reckon, though Joseph were to comport himself in all ways as an Egyptian, and become a child of Hapi and subject of Pharaoh, always accepting the silent reservation. Thus, to be a child of the world meant that he might blithely adapt himself to Egypt's children and move among them, consenting to the high culture of the land. Yet all the while he might feel that they were the children of the world, at whom he gazed benevolently but apart, and ever aware of the mocking spirit in his blood at sight of their decorative and detestable folk customs. The Egyptian year laid hold upon him and whirled him round with itself in the ebb and flow of nature and the rhythmic recurrence of its feasts, of which one or other might be regarded as the first. The New Year's festival at the beginning of the inundation, a day rich in hopes and incredibly tumultuous, a fateful day for Joseph, indeed, as we shall presently see, or the recurrent celebration of the accession of Pharaoh to the throne, when the rejoicing populace renewed the hopes which were bound up with the original day, the beginning of the new dynasty and era, when justice should banish injustice and life be lived amid laughing and amaze, or indeed any other of the recurrent feasts, for they were many. Joseph had first set eyes upon the Egyptian scene at the time of the ebb, when the land had emerged and the sowing had been done. Then he had been sold, and gone on further into the year and round with it. The harvest came, which in name lasted into the flaming summer and the weeks which we call June, and then the diminished stream, amid reverential jubilation, began to swell and climb slowly out of its banks, closely observed and measured by Pharaoh's officials. For it was of the first and last importance that it should rise properly, not too wildly and not too weak, that Kemah's children might have to eat, and the tax-gatherers make it possible for Pharaoh to build. 6 weeks the river rose and rose, the nourisher of the land, quite quietly, inch by inch, day and night, while men slept, and, sleeping, trusted. And then, about the time when the sun was most blazing, and we should have written July, in the second half, which the children of Egypt call the moon of Paophi, the second of their year, and in their first season, which they called Achet, the river swelled mightily, overflowed the fields on both sides far and wide, and covered the land, that strangely and uniquely conditioned land, which had not its like in the world, and which now, to Joseph's wonderment and laughing when he first saw it, was changed into a sacred lake, out of which high-lying towns and villages stood up, connected by causeways. The God stood there, and let his richness sink, and his nourishing mud on all the fields, until the second, or winter season, Peret. Then he began to bait and retire. The waters returned from off the earth continually, as Joseph reminiscently put it to himself, so that beneath the moon of our January they flowed in the old bed, but continued to shrink until summer. It was for 72 days, the days of the 72 conspirators, the days of the winter drought, that the god pined and died, up to that day when Pharaoh's river conservancy announced that it was rising and a new year of blessing took its beginning. It might be moderate, it might be abundant. Amun send, there should not be famine or a scant yield for the tax-gatherers, so that Pharaoh could not build. Time went very fast, Joseph discovered, from new year to new year, or from that moment when he came into the land till the same came round again, reckoning in the Egyptian seasons as he now did, the flood, the sowing, and the harvest, each adorned with its proper feasts, in which Joseph took part with reserve and confiding in indulgence from on high. He must indeed do so, and wear a pleasant face, for these heathen celebrations were involved with the economic life of the land. In Petipre's service, and as the representative of Montcalm, he could not avoid the fairs and markets which were bound up with the religious features of the feasts, since always trade springs up wherever men come together in numbers. There were always markets in the forecourts of the temples of Thebes, on account of the thank offerings. But likewise, up and down the river were many places of pilgrimage, and the people streamed together in great hordes wherever a god held his feast, adorned his temple, possessed oracular wisdom, and promised, along with spiritual refreshment, crowds and booths and general mass jollification. It was not Bastet only, the she-cat of the Delta, who held a feast, of which Joseph had heard so much that was unedifying. Every year there was a popular excursion from near and far to the Ram of Mendes, Jedit in the people's mouth. It was even more jocund than Per Bastet's feast, for Bindidi, the ram, racy and rank as he was, stood closer to the temper of the folk than the she-cat, and during the festivities publicly cohabited with a virgin of the country. But the reader may be assured that Joseph, who went down to the feast on business, did not seek out the sight. being occupied, as the steward's confidential man, solely with the marketing of the paper, tools, and vegetables which he had brought. There was much in the land, and the customs of the land, particularly the feast-day observances, for the feast is the great hour of the traditional, the hour when it comes uppermost and glorifies itself, at which, in all his worldliness, mindful of Jacob, he did not look, or at most with a very detached eye. He did not love the people's love of drink. Recollections of Noah prevented him, as well as the picture in his soul of his sober, pondering father. His own nature, too, though bright and merry, was averse to drunken disorder. For the children of Cana knew no better than to drink themselves drunk on every occasion, with beer or wine, men and women alike. Wine flowed freely at all the feasts, and they and their children could drink 4 days on end and be good for nothing at all. Moreover, there were special feasts of drinking, like the great beer feast, which commemorated the legend of Hathor the Mighty, the lion-headed Sakhmet, how she had raged among mankind to destroy them, and was only prevented from blotting out the race of men by Re, who, with the most clever stratagem, made her drunk on red blood beer. On that day, the children of Egypt drink beer in quite insalubrious quantities, a dark beer called Kes, very powerful. Beer with honey, foreign and home-brewed, the latter mostly in the city of Dendera, seat of Hathor, whither one made pilgrimage to the feast, and it was actually called Place of Drunkenness, as the seat of the goddess of drunkenness. To all this, Joseph paid little heed, and only drank a little, symbolically and socially, to the extent demanded by his business. And some of the practices at the great feast of Osiris, Lord of the Dead, at the time of the shortest day when the sun died, he also, for the sake of Jacob, regarded with but very distant eye. The beast itself, however, with the ritual performances proper to it, interested him very much, and he followed them attentively, for they told again the story of the passion of that mangled and buried and risen God, presented by priests and people in very beautiful masks, faithfully reproducing both the terror and the jubilation of the resurrection, whereat the populace leaped on one leg with joy. Along with this came a deal of primitive foolishness and antique survivals of which nobody any longer knew the meaning, as that various groups of men belabored each other, one group representing the folk of the city of Pe, the other the folk of the city of Dep, and both cities were now entirely unknown. Or a herd of asses was driven round and round the city with mocking shouts and blows from cudgels. A certain contradiction lay in the fact that they treated with blows and contumely a creature which stood to them as a symbol of phallic readiness, for actually the feast of the dead and buried god was likewise a commemoration of the rigid readiness of the male, which tore the mummy wrappings of Osiris, so that Eset, the female vulture, received from him the avenging son. At this time of year, in all the villages, there took place processions of women carrying a phallic emblem as long as an L, which they made to move by means of strings. Thus the worship contradicted the maltreatment, and the reason was after all clear. For on one side, this erection and procreation was a matter of dear life itself, and of fruitful continuance, but on the other, and more strikingly, it was a feast of death. For Usir was dead when the vulture conceived from him. The gods were all erected in death. And just among ourselves, that was the reason why Joseph, with all his personal feeling for the feast of Usir, the mangled one, did not look on at some of the rites, but averted his head, even inwardly speaking. What sort of reason was that? Well, it is hard to talk about so delicate a matter when one knows and the other does not yet see. And that is the more pardonable in that Joseph himself hardly saw it, and only darkly and partially took account of what he did see. A faint, almost unconscious sense of guilt was stirring in him. Guilt on account of disloyalty to the Lord, interpreting the word on whatever plane one may choose. Remember that he thought of himself as dead, and belonging to the kingdom of the dead, wherein he grew. Remember, moreover, that name which he had ingeniously and somewhat presumptuously chosen. After all, the presumption was not so great. Mizraim's children, each one of them, even the least, had long had the right to become Usir when he died, and unite his name with that of the mangled one. As Hoppy the Bull became Serapis in death, the association meant to be dead in God, or to be as God. But just this, to be God and to be dead, brought up the subject of the bandage-rending erection, and Joseph's half-unconscious guilty fear was connected with the intuition that certain moments, for which Dudu was responsible, now beginning to play a role, half of fear, half of joy in his life, were, however remotely, yet perilously connected with that godlike rigidity of death and with disloyalty. There, it is out. With all possible restraint, it has been revealed why Joseph did not care to look on at the popular customs of the Feast of Osiris, or the processions of women, or the cudgeled asses. But he took a good look at much else, in city and country, during the feasts that punctuated and adorned the Egyptian year. Once or twice, as the years went on, he saw Pharaoh, for it came about that the god made his appearance, not alone at the window of audience when he threw down the gold of favor upon favorites in the presence of his elect, but when he came forth in brilliance from the horizon of his palace and beamed in full splendor upon all the people, who, as one man, hopped for joy according to prescribed form, and also because they loved it from their hearts. Pharaoh was short and stout, Joseph noted. His color was not very good, at least not when Rachel's son saw him for the second or third time. His facial expression, too, reminded him of Montcalm when his kidneys troubled him. Amenhotpe III, Neb-Mat-Re, did in fact begin to fail in the years which Joseph spent in Potiphar's house and grew great therein. In the judgment of the skilled priests from the temples and the sorcerers from the bookhouse, he displayed in his physical condition a growing inclination to rejoin the sun. To control this tendency was beyond the power of the priests of healing, for it had all too much natural justification. In Joseph's second year, the divine son of Thutmose IV and the metanic Mutemweya celebrated his jubilee, the so-called Hebsed. That is, it was 30 years since, amid innumerable ceremonies exactly repeated on each anniversary, he had set the double crown upon his head. It had been a regal and splendid life, as good as free from wars, weighed down as with a golden mantle by hieratic pomp and the cares of government, but set off by the pleasures of the chase, in commemoration of which he had issued scarabs, and made splendid above all by his love of building, which he had been able to gratify in full measure. Now all that lay behind him. His nature was as active in decline as Joseph's in upbuilding. In his early days, the majesty of this god had only suffered from toothache, an affliction which he treated by the usual method of chewing balsamic sweetmeats, and often had to receive audience in the throne room with a great lump in his cheek. But since the Hebsed, when Joseph saw him drive out, his bodily ailments were of a more deep-seated kind. Pharaoh's heart fluttered, or beat too quick against his chest, so that it took away his breath. His secretions carried matter which the body should have retained, but could not, because it was breaking down. Later it was not only the cheek that was thick and swollen, but the legs and belly. It was at this time that the confrère and correspondent of the god, who was likewise a god in his own sphere, King Tushratta of Mitanniland, son of Shutarna, the father of Mutemweya, whom Amenhotpe called his mother, in short, his brother-in-law from the Euphrates, for he had received from Shutarna the princess Gulichipa into his house of women, his brother-in-law sent him a magic image of Ishtar, with safe conduct from his faraway capital to the palace at Thebes. For he had heard of Pharaoh's affliction, and in his own case found the image efficacious for slighter ailments. The whole city, yes, all upper and lower Egypt, from the borders of Nubia down to the sea, spoke of the arrival of this image in the palace Merimat, and in the house of Potiphar almost nothing else was talked of for days. But we know that Ishtar of the Road was unavailing, or unwilling to relieve more than temporarily Pharaoh's short breath and swollen limbs, to the satisfaction of his domestic sorcerers, whose gifts of healing were not much help either, simply because the tendency to rejoin the sun was stronger than all else and slowly got its way. Joseph saw Pharaoh at Hebsed, when all Waysay was abroad to see the god drive out in the course of the ceremonies which lasted the whole day. There were investitures, accessions, coronations, purificatory baths assisted by priests in masks representing various gods, incensing, and primitively symbolical procedures. At first, within the palace, in the presence of the great of the land, while outside, the populace, by dint of drink and dance, made themselves believe that from this day forth, time should renew itself from the foundations, and an age of peace, justice, and prosperity, of laughter and universal brotherhood, take its beginnings. This glad conviction had been ardently bound up with the original accession a generation before, and renewed more faintly and fleetingly on each recurrence. But at Hebsed, it sprang up in freshness and festal power in all their hearts, the triumph of faith over knowledge, the cult of an expectation which no experience can banish from the heart of man because it was implanted there from on high. But Pharaoh's progress, when at midday he betook himself to the house of Amun to make sacrifice, was a public spectacle, and many people, including Joseph, awaited it in the west before the gate of Pharaoh's palace, while other crowds lined the route which the royal train was to take through the city, especially in the great Ram Sphinx Avenue, the sacred way of Amun. The royal palace, Pharaoh's great house, from which, in fact, Pharaoh took his name, for the word means great house, though on the lips of the children of Egypt it sounded rather differently, just as in the case of Potiphar and Petipre. Pharaoh's great house, then, lay at the edge of the desert, at the foot of the gleaming, bright-colored cliffs of Thebes. It stood inside a great ring wall with armored gates, which also included the exquisite gardens of the god, and, laughing amid flowers and exotic trees, the lake, which by command of Amenhotpe glittered east of the garden for the delectation of Ti, his consort. The populace outside, though they strained their necks, could see little of the bright splendors of Merimat. They saw the palace guards before the gates, with wedge-shaped leather leaves over their apron kilts, and feathers in their storm helmets. They saw foliage lit by the sun and waving in the wind. Saw airy roofs hovering upon colored columns, long, many-colored streamers fluttering from gilded poles. They sniffed the Syrian odors from the beds of the invisible gardens, and these accorded well with the idea of Pharaoh's godship, since sweet odors are thought of as accompanying the divine. But now, the expectation of the eager, good-natured, lip-smacking, dust-swallowing crowd before the gate was to be fulfilled. Just as Ray's bark reached the zenith, a cry burst out. The guards at the gate raised their spears. The bronze doors between the standards flew open upon the Sphinx Avenue strewn with blue gravel, which ran through the garden, and upon that avenue Pharaoh's train appeared, dashing out through the gate directly into the throng, which swept back and gave way with shouts that were part joy, part fear. Men bearing staves laid into the crowd to make a path for the chariots and horses, with loud cries of, "Pharaoh, Pharaoh, take heed to your heart! Turn away your heads! He drives out! Room, room for his driving out!" And the reeling rout made way. It hopped on one leg. It rolled like a wave in a storm, stretched up its thin arms into Egypt's sunlight, madly kissed hands. The women waved their wailing infants on high, or with heads flung back, offered their breasts in both hands, while the air throbbed with exultation and yearning as they filled it with cries of, "Pharaoh, Pharaoh, strong bull of your mother, lofty in feathers, live a million years, live to eternity, love us, bless us, we love and bless you with fierce ardor, golden falcon, Horus, Horus, Ray you are in your members, Kepper in his true shape, Hebsed, Hebsed, turn of the ages, end of trouble, beginning of joy." A popular jubilation like that is moving. It clutches at the heart even of him who does not quite belong and is inwardly detached. Joseph shouted a little with the rest. He hopped a little, too, with the children of the land. But chiefly he looked on with silent emotion. What moved him was the sight of Pharaoh. He saw the Highest coming forth out of his palace like the moon among stars, and his heart beat responsive to that old legacy, now a little weakened by his cosmopolitan understanding, which bade him serve the Highest, whom alone man shall serve. Long before he had stood even before the next Highest, Potiphar, he had, we know, already bent his thoughts upon still more absolute and final embodiments of that idea. We shall see that even now his eager spirit did not pause. Pharaoh was wonderful to behold. His chariot was pure gold, naught else. Gold wheels, gold sides, gold axles, and covered with embossed pictures, which, however, one could not see, because the whole car flashed and glittered so as it reflected the midday sun that the eye could scarcely bear it. The wheels and the hoofs of the steeds whirled up thick, enveloping clouds of dust, so that it was as if Pharaoh came on in flame and smoke, frightful and glorious to behold. You expected nothing less than that the stallions, too, Pharaoh's great first team, as it was called, would breathe fire from their nostrils. So they danced, so their smooth muscles shone. So wild they were in their ornamented harness with gold breastplates and gold lion's heads on their crests, from which colored ostrich plumes stood up and nodded. Pharaoh drove himself. He stood alone in the chariot of cloud and fire, the reins in his left hand. With his right, he held the lash and crook, the black and white one, in a sort of ritual position, slantingly against his chest, just underneath his jeweled collar. Pharaoh was already rather an old man, one could tell by his sunken mouth, the tired look in his eyes, and his back, which seemed a little stooped beneath the lotus-white linen of his upper garment. The cheekbones stood out in his gaunt face, and it looked as though they were rouged. All sorts and kinds of charms in the shape of stiff emblems and variously knotted and looped ribbons hung down from his hips under his garment. His head was covered to behind his ears and down to his neck by the blue crown set with yellow stars. But on the brow, above Pharaoh's nose, the poison cobra reared, glittering with colored enamel. Rays, talisman. Thus, without looking to left or right, the king of Upper and Lower Egypt drove past before Joseph's eyes. Tall ostrich feather fans swayed over him. The soldiers of his bodyguard, archers and shield-bearers, Egyptian, Asiatic, and Negro, hurried under standards beside the wheels, and officers followed in cars covered with purple leather. Then all the people gave another adoring cry, for after the officers came another single chariot with gold wheels whirling up the dust, and in it a boy, 8 or 9 years old, likewise under ostrich feather fans, driving too, with weak, bebraceleted arms outstretched. His face was long and palish. The full, raspberry-colored lips smiled with charming shyness at the yelling populace. The eyes were half open, from pride or sadness. That was Amenhotpe, the godlike offspring, heir to the throne and crown, when he who drove in front of him should have decided to mingle with the sun. Pharaoh's only son, child of his old age, his Joseph. The recipient of all these plaudits had a thin, childish torso, nude save for the arm rings and jeweled necklace. His apron kilt of pleated gold stuff came high up in the back and down to his calves. In front, where the gold-fringed drawstring hung, it was scooped out, exposing a drum-shaped paunch like a Negro child's. On the boy's brow, the serpent reared, as on the father's. His close-fitting headdress of gold stuff enveloped his head and came together at the back like a knot of hair, while the youth lock of the king's sons hung in the form of a broad fringe over one ear. The populace shouted at the top of their lungs to this engendered but not yet risen sun, the sun below the eastern horizon, the sun of tomorrow. "Peace of Amun," they shouted. "Long live the son of the god! How beautiful you are in the bright places of the sky! Youthful Horus in the childhood lock! Rich, enchanted falcon, protector of the father, protect us!" They still shouted and adored when, after the rabble in the wake of the morrow's sun, followed another fiery chariot with high sides. Behind the driver, as he leaned over the rail, stood T, consort of the god, Pharaoh's chief wife, the lady of the lands. She was small and dark of countenance, with gleaming eyes lengthened by paint, a firm and delicate nose with a pronounced curve. A smile sat on her full curling lips. Anything as beautiful as her headdress there could not be on earth. It was the vulture cap, the whole bird made of gold, covering her head with its body and outstretched head, while the pinions hung down in splendor over cheeks and shoulders. On the bird's back, a ring was fastened, from which rose a pair of high, stiff plumes, converting the cap to a divinity's crown, while in front on the brow, besides the featherless head and crooked beak of the bird of prey, was likewise the uraeus, fanged and erect. Here were the very signs and insignia of godhood. It was too much. The people could not but greet them in ecstasy, and quite beside themselves shriek out, "Eset, Eset, Mut, heavenly mother cow, mother of God, you who fill the palace with love, sweet Hathor, pity us!" They cried out to the princesses, too, who stood embraced in their own chariot behind the driver bent to his steeds, to the ladies of the court driving by twos with the fan of honor in their hands, and to the friends of Pharaoh, the unique and only friends who attended his levee. Thus the Hebsed procession moved among the crowds from the house Merimat to the river, where the gaily colored boats lay ready, and Pharaoh's bark, star of the two lands. And the god, the goddess, and their offspring, with all the court, were set across to the eastern shore, and driven by other teams through the city of the living, attended by the plaudits of the throng in all the narrow streets and from all the housetops. And they drove to the house of Amun and the great incensing. Thus, then, Joseph had seen Pharaoh. As once in the court of his house, he, the bought slave, had seen Potiphar, first of his sphere, and thought how he could come to stand before him. At his side he now stood, thanks to his shrewdness in discourse. But we know that even then his thoughts outran the moment, secretly anticipating a connection with distant and final manifestations of the highest. His audacity even envisaged a still further goal. But how could that be? Was there, than the highest, a higher still? Certainly, when one has in one's blood a feeling for the future, that is to say, for the highest of the morrow. During the exultations of the throng, which Joseph with a certain reserve had shared, he had observed Pharaoh in his fiery chariot with sufficient care. But his inmost and uttermost curiosity had for its object not the old god, but his successor, the lad with the lock and the sickly smiling mouth, Pharaoh's Joseph, the next son. He gazed after the narrow shoulders and gold knot of hair, the thin armleted arms, as the lad drove by. Him, not Pharaoh, he had in his mind when the procession had passed and the crowds followed to the river. With the little coming one, his thoughts were concerned. And it might well be that his opinion was that of the children of Egypt, for they had cried out more fervently at sight of him than when Pharaoh himself passed by. For the future is hope, and in the goodness of God, time is given to man that he may live in hope. Joseph had need still to grow mightily in his station before the hope of standing before the highest or at his side could have the smallest prospect of fulfillment. So then, with reason it was, that as he watched the feast of Hebsed, his gaze passed over the present highest into the future, and rested on the not yet risen sun.